Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 142. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a couple of B-pictures, a couple of crime movies from the middle of the last century. The first one is Hell's Half Acre from 1954, starring Wendell Corey and Evelyn Keyes. And the second one is Seven Thieves from 1960, starring Edward Gene Robinson, Eli Wallach, Rod Steiger, and Joan Collins. So sit back, get some popcorn, and enjoy. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, how's everybody doing? Looks like the spate of celebrity deaths has eased off, which is a great relief to everybody concerned, mostly and primarily celebrities. It's been an interesting few weeks, really, and not without features of interest. The weather here has, of course, been cold because winter still has us in its passive-aggressive grasp. But I'll leave that aside for now. I have been reading a few movie reference books. I picked up a few of them secondhand recently at a place called Tyab Packing House here in Melbourne, which has a very large section of movie reference books going quite cheaply, which is nice. And I've got this anthology called Movies, edited by Gilbert Adair. And there's a really interesting quote in the book and on page 91 saying, and it's by a guy called Christian Metz. And Christian Metz says, a film is difficult to explain because it's easy to understand. Now, if Christian Metz had told me that 7 years ago, and we are coming up on the 7th anniversary of Paleo Cinema Podcast, if Christian Metz had told me that 7 years ago, I'm not sure whether I would have started trying to. Yeah, he's kind of a bit of a defeatist in my book on that one. But that's what I do here. I try to explain movies. I try to recommend movies. I try to express my love of certain movies. And also, even if I don't love them, I try to look at some interesting ones. And this time around, we've got some interesting ones. They're big pictures, both of them. They're between, one's in 1954 and one's in 1960. So they're stock in the middle of paleo cinema time span. And they're more interesting than really, really good. But I kind of like that too. All the really, really good movies, after a while you've seen most of them. There are some gaps in my knowledge, of course. But for the most part, you've seen most of them. But now and then, little quirky films come up that were B-pictures that for some reason weren't released for viewing on television at any stage during my watching movies on television phase. But when you see them, you kind of go, wow, okay, that's cool. Yeah, let's have a look into that a little bit more. And these films are very much in that kind of a space. I have been doing the radio gig, as we know, with ABC local radio across the Northern Territory. I'll just give you a bit of an idea about how big an area ABC radio covers and when I'm doing the radio gig. The Northern Territory of Australia covers an area, and wait for this, 1,420,970 square kilometres. It is our second biggest state. It is fucking enormous. And I decided to look that up the other day when I was thinking about the radio gig, and I thought, my voice is being carried that far. Of course, the internet carries it a lot further, but just the primary audience for the kind of stuff I do and the kind of stuff that Liz Travaskis and Richard Margetson and all the other people on ABC local radio in the Northern Territory do is covering an enormous chunk of the planet. Not as big as some other chunks, but it did kind of wow me a little bit. Now, the last thing we did two things recently on the radio gig. The first one we had to do, which was a look at the career of Robin Williams. That one was kind of difficult in a sense because we really didn't want to go into the grief porn thing. We really didn't want to dwell on the method and the manner and the facts surrounding his death. We wanted to look at his career and take a look at the range of roles he did and the kind of actor he was. So we did that, but it was still quite a difficult one for us to do, both Liz and myself. So we got through that, and then we decided we were going to lighten things up the next week, which was almost a necessity after that quite sad one for Robin Williams. And we looked at a Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly movie called Step Brothers, which is one of my, well, if I was guilty about watching movies, it'd be one of my guilty pleasures. So we did that, directed by Adam McKay, who's been a long-term collaborator of Will Ferrell's. And we had a little bit of fun with that. Next time around, we're doing a Christian Slater film from 1990 called Pump Up the Volume, which I'll be interested to re-watch again this week. And after that, we were going to do one of the cool foodie films that I know, which is Big Night, starring Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub from about a dozen years ago, which I'm looking forward to seeing Liz's reaction on. One of the things I've learned about Liz while we've been doing the radio gig was that she doesn't really like violent films. Violence isn't really her thing, which is a bit of a challenge because Ivor and I, when we were doing it over the 3 years that Ivor Cole and I did it, we could do blokey films and do any kind of movie we liked. We kind of did steer to the blokey films. But with Liz, we've got to change things a little bit, and that's perfectly fine. I don't mind getting taken out of my comfort zone in these things, because you're never learning in your comfort zone. It's only when you go out of your comfort zone that you learn. So I'm looking forward to doing a lot of movies that are different from the stuff I would have picked had I been entirely up to me. And I like that. I like that challenge. And I like going down there on Thursday nights and sitting in the little booth and saying hi to Chris the doorman at the ABC headquarters and just talking about movies for half an hour. It's a great pleasure, it's a great honour to do, and particularly in this time where the new Conservative government is cutting funding to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, our national broadcaster, it really is a pleasure to be able to contribute something to it. So, having said that, I'm going to look now at the movies that I have watched over the last fortnight. Let me just go down the list here, and of course I haven't got things organised because I'm always like that. I'll go backwards from the most recent for upwards. I did see Predator. I rewatched Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Hadn't seen it a long time. Picked up the Blu-ray quite cheaply. And, yeah, it's kind of cool. It's a good action film. There's a whole bunch of it's very much a sausage fest with only one female character who's basically there, so they have one female character. But the alien's good. Stan Winston's work, of course, he was brought in late to look at it and get the monster right, is really good. And the ensemble cast kind of works, and Arnie's there with a cigar and he's gob being Arnie, all that kind of stuff. But I do have a recommendation for you. The previous movie I watched to that one was an Australian film from 2013 starring Aaron Pedersen called Mystery Road. It's also got Hugo Weaving and Jack Thompson in it. It's kind of like an Australian Western in a sense, and a crime film as well. It's about an Aboriginal police detective in a country town in Queensland who's investigating the death of an Aboriginal girl who's found underneath, you know, kind of storm drain underneath a road outside the town. And it goes into all of the details of the dynamics between Indigenous people and the whites in the town. It goes into his personal history, and it goes into his failures as a man, in a sense. And there's a really good climax, a really good action climax to the film as well. So if you really should try to find that. It's called Mystery Road from 2013, starring Aaron Pedersen, one of our best Indigenous actors. He really is fine in this movie. So I'd heard about the movie, but I hadn't seen it. I had it on the hard drive for a very long time. And when I finally watched it yesterday, I was blown away at the quality of it. So I'd recommend that. Let's see what else I have watched. I watched The Most Dangerous Game, the 1932 version with Joel McRae and Leslie Banks in it and Faye Ray. And that was a lot of fun too. It's the usual thing, you know, like mad hunter hunts down human beings on an island. But it's a nice, honest little thriller. And it's kind of interesting to go back and see what action films were like in the 1930s. They were very different from what we now know as action films. But I did enjoy doing that. It was definitely worth my time. Now, the only other couple of things I've seen, but there's a 1953, I think it is, action film called Running Target, which doesn't star any stars, but the story's about a policeman and a posse who are tracing a gang of criminals across some really rugged territory in the Pacific Northwest of America. It's an interesting little film, incredibly small budget, all shot on location in the mountains. And it really is kind of contrary. The policeman doesn't act like a policeman does in a lot of films. He's a sheriff, deputy sheriff. The people are isolated, and all they can get is drops of equipment by aeroplanes dropping equipment with parachutes. And there's an ambiguity about some of the characters, which is kind of cool. Again, this is one of the small films, but it is interesting to see smaller films from previous decades, just to see what people did when they didn't have much of a budget but wanted to tell a good action story. So I'd say that's a recommendation. The only other thing I'd recommend is Bobcat Goldthwait's film from about 2009, starring Robin Williams. It was the movie I watched before doing the radio gig for Robin Williams. And that's World's Greatest Dad, which is a really interesting story. Robin Williams plays the father of a son who's basically a worthless piece of shit. He's a chronic masturbator. He's nasty. He doesn't have any social skills at all. His emotional IQ is in negative figures. And through stupidity in his room, the son dies. And even in spite of the fact that the son's worthless, the father loves his son. The father's name is Lance. Loves his son. So he rejigs the accidental death to look like a suicide and writes a very impassioned suicide note for his son. And this becomes a grief porn meme around the place. The school takes it on, even though nobody at the school ever liked his son. Suddenly in death, he's a popular kid at school. Lance then writes his son's journal, and that gets published as a book. And this poor man who basically wanted his son to be remembered as a better person than he actually was is suddenly in the middle of this grief porn meme storm and has to kind of deal emotionally with the fact that everything people are telling him all the time is a lie. I recommend the film. It is a very raw film, given the method of the son's death and Robin Williams' own death. But I think it really is an interesting film. Bobcat Goldthwait, as a director, is doing some very interesting, very dark comedies. And this is a comedy, in spite of the subject matter. He's doing some very dark comedies. And if you want to look over the last four or five films that Bobcat Goldthwait directed and wrote, you'll find some worthwhile dark comedies there. So that's about it for what I've been watching. So I'm going to take a break now. And then when I get back, we're going to talk about a really interesting little noir film called Hell's Half Acre, starring Wendell Corey, Evelyn Keyes, Elsa Lanchester's in it as well, Philip Arne and Key Luke.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, that's vodka and orange juice.
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that's a screwdriver.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, it's time to look at 1954's Hell's Half Acre, directed by John H. Auer, starring Wendell Corey, Evelyn Keyes, Elsa Lanchester, Marie Windsor, Nancy Gates, Jesse White, Key Luke, and Philip Arne. This is a really unusual film noir for a couple of reasons. The first one is that you don't really think of an actor like Wendell Corey being a film noir protagonist. You think Bogart, you think Mitchum. You think all of those kind of guys, Burt Lancaster. But you don't really think of Wendell Corey as a film noir protagonist. But he does a pretty good job in this one. He was an actor whose career was cut short, as indeed was his life, by problems with alcohol. He died at the age of 54 in the 1960s. And if you look at his later work, it really does show that he wasn't doing well. The thing I remember him most from, and the role of his that I like best, he played Smiley Coy, the fixer, for Stanley Schreiner Hoff, played by Rod Steiger, who's in the other movie I'm going to talk about today, in the Clifford Odets adaptation of The Big Knife with Jack Palance. I've talked about that in a previous Paleo Cinema podcast. And again, I go back and look at that movie, and Wendell Corey is really good as Smiley Coy in that, and really is a piece of shit, basically the character. But in this one, he plays a protagonist, which makes for a slightly unusual movie. Okay, here's the brief precis of the movie. The character of Chet Chester, played by Wendell Corey, owns a successful nightclub in Honolulu. He used to be known as Randy Williams. He was a criminal. He reinvented himself and came back, moved away from his criminal background. And after he was injured and burned in the attack on the USS Arizona during the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, he was reported as dead, and his wife, Donna, then became a war widow in California. Chester saw this as a chance to kind of get away from his old life and get away from his old criminal background and rebuild himself. So he's living in Honolulu with his girlfriend, who's supposed to be Asian. She's got an Asian last name, even though she's played by an Anglo actress called Nancy Gates. And they're doing kind of well until one of his criminal companions from the early days comes back and tries to blackmail him, and basically sends him a note via a very unusual means. I won't tell you what that is because it's a bit of a spoiler, and I'd like to have that little bit not be told. He gives him a note saying, basically, you're dead if you don't get off the islands, or you can give me $100,000. That's your choice. So what happens is Nancy goes back to meet this guy in the office of the nightclub and shoots him. And Chet then decides to take the blame. He's got $50,000 in a safe deposit box in his bank in Honolulu. So he wants her to take it to his lawyer in Los Angeles and arrange to bribe the right people so that he gets off with a very light sentence, if any sentence at all. They call the police, and the police arrest him. And meanwhile, Sally, his girlfriend, is going to go to the safety deposit box, get the money out, and do as he asks. Unfortunately, his business partner, Roger Kong, who was also his business partner when he was a criminal, finds out about this and realizes she's going to grab the money and take it to Los Angeles. He believes he's entitled to half of it, and he hits her, and she falls and dies. Meanwhile, over in the mainland, a record that Chet Chester wrote the song of becomes a bit of a hit, and his ex-wife, Donna, played by Evelyn Keyes, hears the music and realizes that the phrasing of it's the same as the phrasing on a photograph that he autographed for her and gave to her before he went off to Pearl Harbor. And she gets the idea that he might still be alive somewhere in Los Angeles. Now, I'm going to play the audio of that recording that Chet Chester wrote. It's a really tacky piece of kind of Hawaiiana from the period. It's got the narrative. It's got all the ukulele music in the background. It's tackiness, but it's a very important plot point that gets one of the two streams of this plot. First one being Chet trying to get out of trouble. Second one being Donna trying to find out whether her ostensibly dead husband is alive. It's the link between those two things.
Hawaii, I came unwilling, a stranger to you, sick and weary, bitter and tired, all hope dissolved, heart despairing. But when hearing music, I opened tear-sodden eyes, and beauty and color rushed to embrace me, to warm me, to heal me, to make me whole again. And the murmuring waves and tropic trade winds beat into my consciousness, an unceasing rhapsody of tide muted hollow, when raindrops perform silver ballet over white-skirted sea. Land of aloha, of song, of welcome. less idyllic, where trade winds play, where all races are one with one another and God, where joy is in the living, where paradise is now. Island of contentment, of tranquility, of full heart and happy laughter. You have given strength to me who had lost it, restored my faith where faith had waned, made strong my body, which was all but withered, made harmony in my soul, a man of me. I love you. I will never go. I love you, Hawaii. You are my life, my hope, my faith. With your bright and shimmering music-filled loveliness, you are my golden dreams at the rainbow's beginning.
I'm not sure why she'd want somebody back who wrote those kind of that florid prose there, but she does, and there's actually a reason too. She has an 11-year-old son who is the son of Chet Chester, and she needs to kind of have that closure and find out what's happened, more for her son than for herself. Now, Evelyn Keyes, really interesting actor. She did have a supporting role in Gone with the Wind and went on to do a whole bunch of kind of B-grade movies. I remember her from the late 40s in one of my favourite Arabian Nights kind of movies, a thing called 1001 Nights, which also had Cornel Wilde and Phil Silvers in it. But in this, I think it's a really nice piece of work by Evelyn Keyes in this film, because she's playing a woman her own age, which is kind of mid late 30s. She's determined, she's focused, and she has a purpose. And she does go into some very dark places. As she arrives in Hawaii, Chet escapes from jail and hides out in Hell's Half Acre, which is a slum area in Honolulu at the time, which is kind of multicultural. It's a whole bunch of really ratty little units piled up one on top of the other, mostly inhabited by kind of low-life people and criminals. And in order to try to find him, Donna does a couple of interesting things. First off, she decides she's going to be a taxi dancer, you know, like 10 cents a dance kind of girl, to investigate this for herself and for her son as much as anything, and then gets involved with Roger Kong. Soon finds her. This is really great. Philip Arne in this movie is a really nice villain. He is malevolent, he's nasty, and he could be, I mean, they could have done the role Anglo very, very easily if it hadn't been set in Hawaii. But I like the fact that they've given a couple of different Asian actors a real opportunity to shine in this. And, of course, it does give you that multicultural flavour of Hawaii in an interesting way there. So they did go out on a limb a little bit with that, even though they did have Nancy Gates as Chet's Asian girlfriend in the film. They do actually let these actors show their chops, and they both do a fine job of it as well. It's a rare film of that era, early 1950s, that does these sorts of things. Now, there are a couple of other interesting kind of ancillary characters in the film. The first one is Elsa Lanchester's character. She plays, and this is a really groovy thing, it's one of those little bits of work that does delight you when you see it in a movie. She plays Lyda O'Reilly, a taxi driver in Hawaii. I'm just going to play a little bit of the dialogue of when Donna, the Evelyn Keyes character, hops into the taxi when she arrives in Hawaii and encounters Elsa Lanchester's character, who's in the usual line of Elsa Lanchester eccentrics.
The Honolulu police station.
Police station?
Please.
Want to turn yourself in, dear?
I beg your pardon.
I beg yours. Always opening the big mouth. Didn't you just come in on the plane?
Yes, I did.
You live in the islands?
No.
No, it's my first visit. Oh, Amala Heaney, you had me fooled.
Amala who?
That's a newcomer.
Oh. How long have you been in the islands?
35 years. Her name's O'Reilly, Alida O'Reilly. I was a school teacher from Wisconsin. I saved up my money and came here for a 2-week vacation. Forgot to go back. And now that I've told you my life story, maybe I could ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Why Why is it that a nice-looking young woman like you is making her first stop in the islands at the Honolulu police station?
I have an appointment to see Chief Dan.
Welcome to Hawaii.
Thank you.
Please sit down. Our brief telephone conversation last night has me puzzled. I was under the impression you said it was in connection with a man named Chet Chester.
Yes, it is.
I presume you know Mr. Chester is in jail, being held for murder.
Yes, I heard.
May I ask, Mrs. Williams, what your interest is in him?
I'll be brief. Just before the war, there was a young sailor. His name was Randy Williams. He was attached to the battleship Arizona. This was in 1941. On December the 7th, he was reported killed in action.
I fail to see the connection with Chet Chester.
I have reason to believe that Chet Chester and Randy Williams are the same.
Evelyn Keyes' character in this is really interesting because she finds her own inner strength as the movie goes on and doesn't always rely on men to look after her. She goes out and she really does attempt to solve the puzzle that could just kind of demonstrates and puts herself in some serious danger. There are some other minor characters who are denizens of Hell's Half Acre. One of them is played by a character actor who also did a lot of comedy roles in a lot of things. A guy called Jesse White playing Tubby Otis. Now, Tubby Otis's wife, oddly enough, is played by Marie Windsor, who's way out of his league, if you know what I mean. She's an attractive actor and an attractive woman as well, but she's in there playing his wife who wants a better life and is having an affair with Roger Kong. Now, this kind of is an unusual thing for its time, too, the fact that an Anglo actress is playing a character who's having an affair with a Chinese gangster. But they put it across very well, and Marie Windsor gets a chance to play drunk in one scene and is there as another one of the motivators for Roger Kong getting that money back. He wants to start a new life with her character, and they want to move on from there. But something which is only really possible in a place like Hawaii, where what used to be called miscegenation is not an uncommon thing. Her character's name is Rose. So you get all these kind of different characters and different motives clashing together in a very unusual film noir environment. Now, Donna gets captured by Roger Kong, and Roger decides to hide her in the apartment in Hell's Half Acre of Tubby Otis and his wife Rose. And that's where things get very dark in some places. While Rose is away, Tubby Otis tries to sexually assault Donna, though it's done in a very kind of 1950s sort of way, and she screams. And in hiding in Hell's Half Acre is Chet Chester, and that's where they first meet up again. He breaks in, beats up Tubby Otis, and meets the woman who was his ex-wife. Now, he's got a scar on the side of his face, and she hasn't seen him in a lot of years, so there's a little bit of ambiguity about whether he's actually the person she thinks she is. But ultimately, he does admit that he is and finds out that he's got a son. This then changes his motivation for things. Meanwhile, Chief Dan is investigating the murder of Sally Lee, the girlfriend of Chet Chester, and is slowly realizes that it's Roger Kong who is the murderer. And so all of this leads to a very film noir-y kind of climax. But just leaving all of that aside, I find this a really interesting little film. I like the fact that they tried to do things differently. They filmed on location in Hawaii, which was a protectorate, I think, at the time. It was well before it was a state. It was about 5 or 6 years before it was a state of America. And having that different environment, film noir kind of works really well when it steps out of its comfort zone. And I like that too. And I'm talking about comfort zones a bit this podcast for some reason. But when it steps out of the comfort zone, things like Leave Her to Heaven, where it's a bright Technicolor film noir filmed in the northeast of America rather than out on the West Coast. Film noir is a very West Coast kind of thing, though there are a lot of New York kind of film noirs, but it's very much an urban thing, and that's a country set, really, a country set film noir, whereas this one is kind of a Polynesian Hawaiian film noir, which is a very unusual thing. And I think the acting is universally strong in this film. I don't think there's a really weak bit of acting in it. Jesse White's really good. Philip Barnes, very good. Key Luke's very good as the police detective. And nobody even mentions the fact that he's an Asian-American police detective. It's taken for granted in that kind of environment, which is kind of cool too. And it does give the film a bit of a contemporary feel in that sense. There isn't all of that uncomfortableness about race that sometimes appears in movies of the time. That kind of self-consciousness isn't really apparent in there, which is kind of cool and does make it a lot more approachable from our point of view too. Movies that are ahead of their time when it comes to things like race and women's rights and sexuality and all sorts of things like that do play better to a modern audience. Now, I'm not saying this is a perfect film at all. It's a bit like the line that Stanley Donen once said about movies, and I'm just going to get that from my reference book because I did look this up in a reference book and I found it really, really cool. Stanley Donen, the film director, once said, "The cinema is like sex. When it's good, it's wonderful. But even when it isn't good, it's still pretty wonderful anyway." And this movie kind of rates as one of those pretty wonderful anyway kind of movies. It's it was filmed by Republic Studios. It was a very minor studio. It wasn't done in widescreen or anything like that. It was done in the old Academy ratio. I don't believe the budget was incredibly large. I think a lot of it was shot on studio sets in Los Angeles, even though there is some location shooting, mostly second unit. But I think it's worth your time and worthwhile. It's a tough film. It's a little gritty. It's got that grittiness that we expect from a good film noir. It's got a kind of almost a reversal of the normal film noir tropes in the fact that there really isn't a femme fatale in the movie, but there is a guy whose criminal past has come back to get him. And one of the plots of the film is how he redeems himself from that and how he makes things right by the people he's left behind in his past. And the other side of it too is the Evelyn Keyes character, Donna Williams, getting her closure on a previous relationship. She's got a kind of fiancé in Los Angeles, and she leaves him deciding that she needs to get this sorted and settled in some way because she can't marry her fiancé if her husband's still alive. She doesn't believe that's right. And she also owes it to her son to have the story of his father told, even though ultimately that's not going to be told in exactly the way that she initially wants it to be. But I like it too. It does have the strong female character in it. It does have the unusual casting of people like Wendell Corey and Jesse White, Philip Barnes and Key Luke in the film. And it works. It works as a film noir. It works as a good, honest little B-picture. And I'm not sure where it's available. You can probably get it on somewhere like Netflix, or it may well be on Amazon or something like that, but look around and see what you can find for this movie, because it is definitely worth looking into if you're interested at all in film noir. Now, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to move ahead another 6 years to a movie that came out about 6 months before the original Ocean's 11, and that is the 1960 film Seven Thieves, starring Edward G. Robinson, Joan Collins, Eli Wallach, and Rod Steiger. Again, is in some very interesting casting.
For years, I've known it couldn't happen without the proper ingredients, the right temperature, the right spark to set it off. But now, suddenly, all the conditions are right. With a little daring, the experiment can be made to work.
But I don't want to stick around to find out. Not even for 1/7 of $4 million?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Edward G. Robinson. Meet the Seven Thieves. Each human being like a sharp precision instrument with a job to do. There was the professor, played by me. He held the key to the crime of crimes. Paul, played by Rod Steiger. He didn't like his girl being used as bait.
Now, don't you have any conscience about setting yourself up as a man-trap?
Melanie, played by Joan Collins, the dancer who kept them looking the other way.
Could you believe in the morals of a woman whom you've seen almost naked?
Pancho, the beatnik, as the phony baron, played by Eli Wallach, ready to swallow cyanide pills as part of the grand deception.
I measure danger only in terms of profit.
LeMay, played by Alexander Scorby. He sold out Monte Carlo for the touch of a woman's lips. Louis, played by Michael Dandy, an artist among safecrackers. And Baumer, the strong boy, played by Barry Kroger. He didn't feel dressed without a gun. But for the moment, Melanie was stealing the show. And while she turned every head in the place, the cleverest thieves in the business were committing the robbery that rocked Monte Carlo, the world's best protected city.
Okay, that's the trailer for Seven Thieves, a 1960 crime picture starring Edward G. Robinson. Oh, well, you've just heard who it's starring. It was directed by Henry Hathaway, who was a studio guy for a long time. It was made by 20th Century Fox, and this is slightly unusual for me. Tell me if you think this is unusual. But it was filmed in CinemaScope, which is kind of cool, widescreen format, but in black and white, so it was obviously a big picture. The A Pictures had it all in colour, but this one was actually filmed in black and white. And it's set on the French Riviera, where these guys are doing this robbery of the Monte Carlo casino. But there's this thing that they did in studios at the time, where the second unit would go away and find lookalike actors to film the long shots of people walking on beaches or along the waterfront in places like Monte Carlo. They had people over there already in Europe who do the second unit stuff. And then they'd back project the actors against a reprojection screen showing all of the beautiful scenery. And that's what they do in this film. It was filmed all in Los Angeles with the second unit and the reprojection stuff done in Europe, which looks a little bit obvious to our viewpoint these days. But it was something that was well established at the time. And you can look at any number of films that were supposedly filmed in Europe, where there's no real evidence that the main actors ever went anywhere near the place. You'll see a lot of it in episodic TV at the time too, and well into the 60s and 1970s as well, where you've got a European establishing shot, but all the actors are actually sitting on a soundstage in Burbank or something like that. But having said that, this is a really interesting little film. It was based on a novel by a kind of adventure novelist at the time, who wrote lots of adventure stories, called Max Cato. It's based on a 1959 novel of his called The Lions at the Kill. Max Cato did a whole bunch of other books that were adapted into some quite interesting films. His 1950 book, The Killing Frost, ba-boom, was made into Trapeze, which starred Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis well before they did Sweet Smell of Success. Then you've got A Prize of Gold, 1953, was made into a 1955 movie called A Prize of Gold. The Devil at 4 o'clock, 1961 movie starring Spencer Tracy and Frank Sinatra, was based on a novel of the same name by this guy. Mr. Moses and Murphy's War, from 1971, the Peter O'Toole movie, is based on Murphy's War, a novel by Max Kenneth. So he's got a good long history of doing books that were adapted in some quite interesting, quite good films. And this one's not real exception. I kind of like it. It came out roughly, as I said, a little while before Ocean's 11 in 1960, with a very similar robbing the casino viewpoint. I watched this film a few days ago, and one of the things that happened last night that kind of rolls into this in a very personal and weird kind of way is that yesterday Sally and I went to the Melbourne casino. We were going there for her uncle's birthday. It was her uncle's 30th birthday, which requires some explanation. Sally's auntie Lee married a man, Anurag, his name is, a very nice guy, a really top guy, who was younger than her older son. And between them, they got a few bucks behind them. So they invited a whole bunch of friends and family to a 30th birthday party at the conservatory at Crown Casino, which is quite a posh dining establishment. And it's all done smorgasbord style, all you can eat smorgasbord kind of thing, but top quality food. So we're there at the casino. We'd just been through the main body of the casino, so, because to get from the car parking to where this restaurant is, we had to go through two different levels of roulette tables and paygal tables and poker machines and all sorts of other devices by which people are leached of their money in order to get to the conservatory. The food was fantastic. Immense amounts of choice. I ate until I was stuffed like a Strasbourg goose. But then I thought about Seven Thieves. Were we not getting free food, I wouldn't have been anywhere near the casino at the time. And so I thought about Seven Thieves and how much I detest Crown Casino, which gets a whole bunch of different deals with the government. It's just had its license extended to 2050, when the license wasn't up for renewal for another 15 years. So there's that kind of link between Crown Casino as a business and state government in Victoria, where I live. And I thought how much I disliked it, even though the food was great and the company was excellent. And we caught up with a number of Sal's relatives that we don't see often enough, even though that we live in the same city. And I got the idea in my head that I wanted to steal from Crown Casino because they're leeching bastards and I don't like them. And I'd just seen a movie where somebody stole $4 million from a casino. So I've got Sal sitting down next to her auntie Lee. I'd just gone and got some desserts. And some of the desserts are served in these really nice little glass espresso cups. So I said to Lee, "Tell Sal to put this into her purse for me, will you?" And Lee and Sal and I conspired to steal one Pyrex glass coffee mug from Crown Casino. And we succeeded. We got away with it. There are security cameras everywhere, and we got away with stealing from a casino. And I felt unreasonably and childishly good about that. I was quite pleased with myself. I had accomplices, two attractive women as my accomplices, in fact. And I succeeded in stealing in a very small way from a casino, which makes this movie even better for me. And yes, it's childish. Yes, it's wrong to steal. I don't recommend anybody does it. But I did. And I'm not going to be ashamed of it. But just to move away from my life of crime and start talking about the movie, let's see, Seven Thieves. I think that IMDb has a pretty good pricey of this one, though Edward G. Robinson did have a really nice hand at getting the thing worked. So here we go. In Monte Carlo, Theo Wilkins recruits his young protege Paul Mason, just released from prison, to help him rob the famous casino of $4 million. The plan is straightforward. On the night of the governor's ball, Theo will create a distraction in the casino by having one of the team collapse, requiring urgent medical attention. During that time, Paul and another member of the crew will get the money from the vault. When the ambulance arrives, the money will leave with the sick man. The plan is a good one, but not everyone will survive the robbery, and no one will get rich from it. Now, that's not really a spoiler, because you've got to remember this is during the production code years. This is before the end of the production code, and people weren't allowed under American censorship to get away with crime. So the cast on this one, really top cast, and playing against type in some cases. Paul Mason is played by Rod Steiger, a burly actor. And Rod Steiger never plays nice. He always plays brusque and kind of aggressive and not really a friendly kind of person. And he's the protagonist in the film. He plays Paul. He's had a previous relationship with Edward G. Robinson's character, Theo. Theo is the brains of the deal. They recruit Poncho, played by Eli Wallach, who's a beatnik saxophone player who plays saxophone in accompaniment of an exotic dancer called Melanie, played by a young and very attractive Joan Collins. Now, people can think of Joan Collins as she was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But in 1960, she was very, very hot. There's no argument about it at all. She was muy caliente, as they say in Spanish. And she actually does a couple of exotic dances in the nightclub scenes of this film. They were choreographed by Candy Barr, a stripper from the 1950s, who also did one, I think, porno reel of some kind. So Joan Collins does have some, wearing skimpy clothing of the time, has a couple of quite erotic dance scenes in this film. Again, it's 1960. You're not going to see anything too much. But there's a lot of symbolism of Eli Wallach playing a saxophone, kneeling on the floor while Joan Collins gyrates around him. It is quite an interesting scene in that. The other characters in the movie, Alexander Scorby playing Raymond LeMay, who's the inside guy at the casino and who Melanie plays up to. There is the implication that Melanie may be a part-time hooker. She denies that she is when her and Paul become closer, and the romantic interest in this film is predominantly between Paul Mason and Melanie, so Rod Steiger and Joan Collins. But Poncho's in there as well, Eli Wallach, and Eli Wallach's very good in this film. There are a couple of scenes where Eli Wallach really does have to bring out the heavy guns as far as acting chops are concerned. He does a really good job on it. You've then got Michael Dante playing Lou, the safecracker. An interesting actor. He's still acting, in fact, but doesn't make much of an impression in this film. Barry Kroger, the heavy. He's kind of a big, husky kind of actor. You might have seen him in any number of films. They've got a couple of other people you might know in the movie as well. Those are the Seven Thieves are the main characters. But you've got Sebastian Cabot, who people remember from all sorts of things like Family Affair in the 1960s, playing the director of the casino. You've got Marcel Hilaire, an actor who played Frenchman because he was one for a long time. And just a few other familiar faces in it. But this one is quite a nice little caper film. I like it for a number of reasons. I do like the fact that Rod Steiger is playing against type. Paul is very cynical about the idea that Theo has for organising the robbery. He really doesn't play well with others to a certain extent, but he's a career criminal. He knows what he's doing, and he and Melanie become close because at first he treats her disrespectfully, and then when she calls him on it, which she does, which is an assertive thing and not to be dismissed even in the context of these movies, he does realise that he's been an asshole and attempts to amend it, not particularly because at that stage he wants to get with her, as the little kiddies say, but because he's got an underlying moral code where if he's wrong, he's wrong, and he admits to it. And this underlying moral code does serve him in good stead as the movie progresses. Now, the plan to rob the casino is pretty good. What happens is Edward G. Robinson plays a doctor whose patient, an invalid nobleman in a wheelchair, is played by Eli Wallach. Now, at a certain point while they're in the casino, Eli Wallach's character is supposed to swallow a cyanide capsule with a certain amount of cyanide in it, just enough to fake a heart attack. And Poncho is quite nervous about this, and rightly so. If they get the dosage wrong, it can be lethal. So there's that tension as the time approaches for him to take this pill and to have all the symptoms of a severe heart attack. Poncho does get quite nervous on it. And a lot of the tension in the robbery scenes is that kind of, you know, will Poncho take the pill or won't Poncho take the pill? And what will they do if he doesn't? And how are the guys going to get back out again if Joan Collins' character is recognized as an exotic dancer from the town nearby rather than the sophisticated socialite that she's pretending to be while she's in the casino with them because she's there as a part of the team? So there are all these little places where the robbery can go wrong. And the tension does ramp up nicely. Henry Hathaway does a good job on this one of cross-cutting between the different characters and just how they're showing what they're doing. The robbery is done old school, which means basically they've got to drill a hole in the safe and then manipulate the tumblers in a certain way in order to open it. Then they've got to hide all the loot in the underneath the wheelchair for the invalid guy. They've got to find a way for the invalid guy after he has a heart attack, Poncho, the character is, getting him into the right position for the secret lift between the office of the casino manager and the vault. There are all these kind of little bits and pieces that have to fall together nicely to make it work. It's not helped by the fact that the safecracker played by Michael Dante is scared of heights, and part of what they do requires them to crawl around the outside of the building above a very high cliff overlooking the Mediterranean. But, you know, that's one of those things. This is, in a sense, in some ways, it's a by-the-books caper film. But you could argue the point that Rod Steiger is miscast in this movie. I think he's cast against type, but I don't think particularly he's miscast because there's a moral arc to the character which has a payoff after the robbery. Now, there are three different payoffs after the robbery. There are three little twists to the plot after the robbery occurs. One involves the death of a character, one involves money, and one involves luck. So those three things all come together to make this film just that little bit interesting at the end. At least one of the twists is very unrealistic and very unlikely, but it does provide a satisfying ending. And one of the other twists provides an illumination for the nature of certain characters. So that's kind of cool and interesting. And again, with an ensemble cast like this, one of the nice things you see is there's a chance for each of the actors to shine. Everybody gets their little spotlight in the sun. Everybody gets to have a little set piece where they do quite well, and it does work. It is interesting casting. I mean, Edward G. Robinson, of course, had played gangsters in the 1930s and 1940s. In the 1950s, he did have a lot of problems with the tax office. He was almost black banned as a part of the blacklist. And the tax office took away. He had a lovely collection of modern art. And he lost all of that as a part of all of these reverses in his life in the 1950s and all the troubles he went through. And you can see him in films like this and in 2 weeks in Another Town, where he's playing a sadder but wiser kind of character. And a lot of that's reflected in the life of Edward G. Robinson. He didn't have an easy life in some ways. Then you've got Joan Collins, who was the ingenue du jour in the 1950s in things like Girl on a Velvet Swing and things like that. She started out in the very late 1940s doing little melodramas in England, went over to America, and then much later in her life, in the 70s and 80s, reinvented herself in some ways. She was in The Stud, for instance. She did nude scenes when she was in her late 40s. She then went on to do Dynasty and things like that and kind of become an iconic bitch in a sense. But and, of course, she was in an episode of Star Trek, the original series. So you've got her. You've got Eli Wallach, whose career went from the 1950s right up until the 2010s and who died this year. And then you've got Rod Steiger, who was married to Claire Bloom for a long time, the actor Claire Bloom. But in this role, he really is playing against type in a way that I find interesting. And I haven't seen any other role of his that's anything like this. Even though he is playing a kind of rough criminal. It's a kind of role that a much handsomer actor would play normally in this kind of film. And because Steiger was obviously the chunky and not particularly pretty man he was, having an actor like that play this kind of role is interesting and does give him a chance to not only have a couple of decent action scenes, but actually play the romantic lead, which takes a little while for us to get our head around. It did take a little while for me to get my head around anyway, that Rod Steiger playing the romantic lead in a crime caper film. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that movies do lend themselves to cliches, particularly in these kind of roles. But, I only heard about this movie because it was mentioned in one of the obituaries that was done for Eli Wallach, and they said they liked a little bit of business he did in Seven Thieves. So I looked up the movie. I found a copy of it, and I watched it. It's a good, honest crime movie, caper movie. It's not Rafifi in any way, but, I kind of like it. I like Joan Collins dancing in the movie. That is quite striking and hot. And I like the ensemble, too. The ensemble kind of works, though. The four main characters being Edward G. Robinson, Joan Collins, Rod Steiger, and Eli Wallach tend to get most of the love in this film. But, yeah, it's a nice little crime thing. And again, like the previous film I talked about, Hell's Half Acre, really it shows that there is a virtue to looking at B-films and to finding the quirky ones, not just the ones where it's all cookie-cutter plotting and cookie-cutter casting and cookie-cutter locations, but the ones where they actually find a quirky way to do things and play against your expectations of this kind of film. And this movie does, with those three reverses at the end of the film, it does it with the casting of Steiger, for instance. It does it with the nightclub scenes between Eli Wallach and Joan Collins. It does it. And it's I look forward to finding more films like this where I'd heard nothing about them, and they're becoming increasingly rare as I find out more about movies. But the ones where I knew nothing about them at all, and suddenly they pop up on my radar and I watch them, I go, why didn't I know about this movie earlier? It's fun, it's interesting, it's not Citizen Kane, but on the other hand, it's a good, honest little entertainment, and that's very much what Seven Thieves is. I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, I'm going to wrap this up. I've got to do the credits, and I've got to plug the Patreon campaign just one more time. That was the Beatles with their version of The Sheik of Araby. Now, I'm playing that for a particular reason, and it's a weird one. I had a dream last night. I dreamt that I was walking down the street, and I met Dean Martin. And Dean Martin and I walked around and found a nice little restaurant, and walking into the restaurant was Michael Caine dressed as an Arab sheik. Now, maybe in my subconscious mind I got Michael Caine mixed up with Peter O'Toole, I don't know. But either way, Dean Martin and I started singing The Sheik of Araby to Michael Caine, which is one of those kind of weird fucked up dreams that only a movie buff would ever have. And so because the song The Sheik of Araby is stuck in my brain now, I thought I'd share it with you and stick it in yours, if you'll excuse the expression. Now, it's time. I didn't get any feedback, which I would love to get feedback. MP3 feedback would be fantastic if anybody can rock up and give us some of that. You can email it to cultguruwithak@gmail.com. But it's now time to do the credits. Now, these credits are based on the people who have donated to the Patreon campaign for the podcast. You can go to patreon.com/paleocinema, one word, lowercase, and donate as little as $1 a month toward the covering the costs of the podcast. And this wonderful microphone I'm sitting in front of is the first thing that I got with the Patreon campaign, and I love the sound quality of it. I love the fact that I don't have a headphone mic that I can really fuck up the breathing into with, and it's a lovely Blue Yeti microphone, and thank you to everybody who donated that. I've got one other person to add to the credits, and that is the wonderful Matt-O-Matic, who has also donated to the podcast. But here are the credits now. I will see you guys next week with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast, which hopefully will have a guest. And in the meantime, keep enjoying good film. And by the way, Matt-O-Matic, you are the rattlesnake wrangler for the podcast. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved, and if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema.